This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, staff writer Vincent Cunningham is a man of wide interests, one of which is religion. And recently he spoke with the scholar David Bentley Hart, the author of a completely new translation of the New Testament from the Greek. That's an enormous undertaking, but also it's controversial because of how Hart approached the translation. Hart is a literalist. His version of the Bible is, in his own words, almost pitilessly literal. Words and phrases that are accepted by Christians as doctrine suddenly get replaced with unfamiliar or ambiguous terms. Nothing is smoothed over or clarified. If the original text is in badly written Greek, then Hart translates to badly written English. But in these literal renderings of the Gospels, he finds a worldview that is sometimes at odds with the mainstream of Christianity. Here's The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham with David Bentley Hart.
I guess we should start, David, by just asking a little bit about your translation of the New Testament. What was it that you thought was missing from prior translations that you were trying to capture with yours?
Well, there are strengths and virtues of many prior translations. Obviously, I wouldn't dream of trying to rival, say, the King James or the Coverdale for literary quality. But translation of the Bible only began in the 16th century at a time when doctrinal tradition had pretty much predetermined how certain words and certain concepts were going to be rendered. And so part of the appeal of trying to do my own translation was simply to see if I could get back to the text without all those presuppositions translating the text for me in advance.
I guess I could also just ask a more basic question is, why do people keep retranslating the Bible at all? I think some people would wonder, isn't there a quote-unquote correct translation by now? What is the urge to translate and translate again this this text?
Well, you could ask the same about Homer, in a sense. I mean,
yeah,
more and more translations of Homer are appearing, and they're not getting any better.
Yeah.
But in the case of obviously, Scripture, there's more at stake for people, obviously, because people do try. There are many, millions, actually billions of people who at least putatively try to model their lives on these texts and these traditions and these words.
Right.
And so it's always a matter, I think, of burning interest to get it right. I think it's good to unsettle us too, because of course when we think we've gotten it right, we're always in danger of becoming intolerant, self-satisfied, dogmatical, cruel fundamentalists, that it's always healthy to be reminded that we've been getting most of it wrong most of the time. The most popular Protestant translation of the 20th century was the New International Version.
I grew up with that, yeah.
Right. There could scarcely be a more inaccurate translation, but it wasn't inaccurate by accident. Again and again and again, meanings were imposed on the text by translators who felt that their interpretation was the right one doctrinally and therefore the interpretation rather than just a plain translation. One of my favorite examples of this is the way we tend to translate the New Testament. I mean, the Lord's Prayer. The prayer has become the universal property of all Christians and even persons outside of Christianity, perhaps. But in its original form, it's very much a prayer for the poor in a state of real urgency, of privation, of economic duress. But you lose that in the translations that we have, where words like ophelimata, debts, become trespasses. And even if they become debts, they're understood as often as moral debts or spiritual debts. Whereas in the original The original, he really is talking about debt. This was the great crisis of the poor at the time, as it tends to be in any age. But indebtedness was destroying the rural poor of Judea and the Galilee. And when he talks about daily bread, he means bread, you know, epiousion, tonarton imon epiousion, thus he means simaron, means very simply, give us enough bread to get us through this day. Don't take us to court, really, ton pirasmon, because the courts of the time, a great many of the poor were being hauled into the courts by their creditors and plundered of what little possessions they had because of the predatory lending practices of the time. And rescue us from the evil man or the wicked man, apotuponiru, not from evil in the abstract, but from a wicked creditor who wants to rob you legally in the courts. In its unadorned and original form, it's very much a prayer for the poor against the injustices worked on them by the rich.
Given the Advent season, as the Christian world waits for Christmas to come, I wonder if we could talk more specifically about the narrative that begins all four of the Gospels, the birth of Christ, the Christmas story, that you, in the course of your translation, learned or kind of discovered about this very foundational story that had been obscured for you previously.
I was reminded again with Luke how much for him has to do with Christ being the revelation of the God who comes to the humble and the dispossessed and to the people who have no names, in society and in history. And he comes as that kind of liberator. I mean, the Christmas story is a story about the indigent and the oppressed.
Right.
These are stories of poor people under an oppressive regime, displaced people even, having to flee the country, seeking refuge, seeking asylum elsewhere. It reminded me that the profession of Christian faith and throughout history, but in America with a special kind of perversity perhaps, seems at times to be utterly unrelated to the actual content of the Gospels.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting, this dynamic, you know, when people talk about the gospel in the terms that you've laid out, especially with respect to asylum seekers and refugees, people without a place to kind of even lay their heads, they're accused of politicizing the gospel. But I mean, your claim is that, not your claim, I mean, what you uncover is that the politics are there, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's like saying that you're spiritualizing the God. I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, admittedly, the early Christians didn't represent what we would think of as a political movement now, because they had no concept of overthrowing or changing a system of government and replacing it with another. But it is a polity. It is a distinct polity. It is a distinct prescription of how persons are supposed to live together under the shadow, so to speak, of the pronouncement that Christ has risen from the dead, right? Well, a little bit of Greek. Podese idomen pinonte, idipsonte, izinon, iimnon, asthani, infilaki. I mean, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or ill or in prison?
Right.
Well, I mean, that language has a remarkable resonance at the moment when you consider that the atrocities that the current administration here has committed against asylum seekers, it's almost a perfect one-to-one correspondence between that language in the gospel and what we see unfolding at our southern borders. And yet the voices, especially, I hate to say it, of the white evangelical community, seem to be on the side of the goats, not the sheep. I mean,
we could go into that a little bit. One of your recent pieces talked about why some sort of communitarian economics, you know, communism, socialism, however you want to slice it, makes more sense in a Christian context.
Well, I mean, as I say, the texts are quite explicit, and blunt the edge of some pronouncements, but others are right there at the mm-hmm. surface. I mean, Christ explicitly right. tells his disciples, you can't own anything if you want to follow me. You can't hold on to any property. Riches are condemned out of hand by Christ, quite clearly. Right. That the early church in Jerusalem was a communalist collective. You know, they lived together in yeah. one place. They counted nothing as their own. They had no private property. Now, you can understand historically why this would be a very difficult form of life to sustain, especially, you know, with the privations and difficulties of ancient culture or any culture.
Sure.
But it is explicitly there. I mean, it is central to Christ's preaching. I've been attacked actually for writing articles that consist in little more than a catena of verses drawn directly from the text by, you know, house theologians at places like the Acton Institute, which, you know, is a place that's sort of dedicated yeah. to trying to reconcile Christianity with libertarianism, which is, about as hopeless yeah. a task as you can imagine.
But that task seems to have been pretty successful in America.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, America is a great Gnostic adventure at the end of the day. I'm not sure Christianity will ever reach these shores, but if it does, it's going to find a very intractable people here, very hard to convert.
That's David Bentley Hart, whose translation of the New Testament was published by Yale University Press. He spoke with staff writer Vincent Cunningham.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.